The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
So, you know, we've been talking for the last 3 weeks about formulating a market strategy around a complex disruptive technology, and now we'll start on the next major subject, which is executing. But before that, let me just briefly go over it. And remember, there are different kinds of reasons you do a strategy, some more incremental. We are after disruptive innovation in this class. That's what we are after here. Not because it's the best, but, you know, it's a big world out there, and we're focusing on disruptive innovation. And we are using as our overriding case study the internet. We all know that. And then we looked at IBM in particular and the decisions we went through in embracing the internet. And in the seminar two, we talked about the key market factors, which were these. Was the technology ready? Yes, it was ready. How did you know it was ready? Because the marketplace was embracing it, dummy. You know, that's often the most important reason why something is ready. And even if you say, I have no idea what those people are doing out there, well, then you better goddamn find out, because they are doing something. And now, you may decide it's not for you, but at least you better analyze it. And that's essentially what we did, is understand what's going on out there, what are the marketplaces doing, what are competitors doing, what are our clients doing. And once we looked at that, it was obvious that we had no choice but to go into it. And, of course, once you have no choice, then you get to the head of the parade and embrace it. I mean, and embrace it not cynically, but you really embrace it. And then the second major part are what I would call the organizational factors, which is now you have to pick a way of framing your strategy that fits you. And with disruptive innovations, there isn't just one way to do it. And each company has to fit what best fits their competencies, their products and install base, their organization and culture, and what they have brand permission to go after. And sometimes you cannot find a total fit, but the more of these things you can fit, that is, where you want to go with where you are, the easier it's going to be to move in those directions. And as we said, with IBM, I think the breakthrough, and it was a breakthrough we learned by watching what our customers were doing, like UPS, FedEx, and others, the breakthrough was to say, okay, there are a lot of people out there that are saying this web stuff is brand new, it's a whole new infrastructure, it has nothing to do with existing IT. In fact, all the existing businesses are going to die because the new economy will take over and all the born to the web businesses will replace all the existing businesses. Trust me, people were saying that, because that was a way of getting a lot of money from VCs, which most of them squandered in, I don't know how, but they squandered lots of monies. And what we did, and I thought this was very smart, is, as you can imagine, our clients didn't like to hear that message. God, you mean everything I've built, you know, I'm a retailer and I have physical stores. Like, I was in Paris at a meeting in 97, and I was talking to the CIO it was a conference of a major Spanish retailer, El Corte Inglés. It's a huge retailer in Spain. And they said, you know, we just remodel all these stores, and all these people are saying, it's over. Everybody will buy from home. I said, well, I don't think so. And we said, look, everything you have is a wonderful base to build on. What is critical is that you embrace the new technologies, because the web now gives everything you have in your IT world universal connectivity and reach. And so all the stuff you have is far more valuable if you integrate it with the web, the internet, browsers, and so on. And that's what we call the business. And that was a strategy that resonated, at least with our clients. It wasn't a good strategy for everybody. If you were a brand new business, you know, it made no sense for you. But for a company like IBM, that made a lot of sense. We did e-business, which turned out to be pretty successful. And then let me spend a minute on this slide, which I went through very quickly last time. I think that one of the hardest things to do with formulating disruptive innovation strategies is this notion of striking a balance. Because it is as bad to ignore the innovation as it is to fall head over heels in love with the innovation and ignore your base. It's equally bad. If you ignore your innovation, you'll die, because over time you won't be able to get any growth and everybody else will move into the future. If you ignore your base, you'll die because you'll run out of cash. You may be having a ball in all this innovation for a while, but eventually you'll notice that new businesses don't make money for a few years. They take money for a few. You have to invest in them, whether it's an entrepreneurial business or a new business within a company. And where does the money come from to feed the new business? Well, it comes from your legacy businesses, which is where you generate cash. They have high profit margins because they are more mature. You don't need to invest as much. They are not growth businesses, but they are cash-generating businesses. And then you can take that cash and invest it in your new stuff, let alone leverage your skills, your talents, start moving them over. So this notion of striking a balance is incredibly important and not easy to do. It's easy to fall in either way. And if you say, and there is no recipe for balance. Each case will be a little bit different, but you really need a balance. Before we go on to the next section, any comments or questions? Please. Absolutely. You have to handle your customer relations very delicately, because, in fact, the ideal is to help your customers strike a similar balance. Because you are trying to convince your customers to stay with you for the install base and stuff like that, but you also have to make the promise that you'll take them into the future. And you know, that's the ideal, is that, and in fact, if you have a really good relation with your customer, one of the things they will love about the relationship is that you are making a promise to keep bringing them new technologies for the future while helping them continue with their present businesses. But all that takes tremendous nurturing, which is why, don't forget, the premise I've said all along is that you cannot be a leader of the business, no matter how great an engineer, and not have marketplace contact. You need to do great jobs in engineering things, but how do you learn this balance? The biggest learning is in the marketplace, because by watching your customers and what works for them, chances are that's what you should be doing inside the business, because in the end you want to serve them.
In this particular case, we're talking about disruptive technology that was very complementary to the IT systems sort of underlying.
Remember, we framed it that way. Exactly. It didn't have to be.
So what if it's not complementary and replacing, you know, in a way you, you know, then I don't know how you would do that.
Well, let's can we take an example?
I was trying to think of one of it, and I was thinking, okay, the gate just takes a DVD. That's not that good one.
No, that is good. And well, talk and ring. Remember, one strategy is we embraced Ethernet. So sometimes we saw the light, we embraced the Internet, we said that was good or screwed up or whatever. So there are times. Now, if we were only in the talk and ring business, that would have been a problem. But but that's a very important thing. But for example, right now, let's stay with DVD. So right now, as you know, there is this huge battle between Blu-ray and HD DVD. Now, my expectation is at the end of the day, the customers could care less. They just want one to win. And whoever loses should quickly embrace the other and move on. They will lose some revenues because I think you get a license, something or another. But you just have to move on.
So they continue to battle out until the market says who's the winner, or should one of them just begin to embrace the economy?
Yeah, and that's a very interesting mating dance, which is. I hope Sony and Toshiba, which are the champions of each, have plan Bs. In other words, at the same time they say, I hate it, in the back room they have the people that have the Blu-ray strategy for Toshiba. I know that, while Microsoft hates Linux, there are people in Microsoft that could care less that, Linux is Linux. And so they would have strategies so that should Linux gain more and more acceptance, how about Office on Linux? So you do that. And Lou Gerstner, on these cases, he always talked about the notion of sophisticated competition, because at the extreme, sophisticated competition. An example is, so you're playing a tennis match and you want to kill the person at the other side of the net, but after a match is over, you go have a beer. And in most businesses, let's say IBM and Oracle, we compete like crazy in certain areas, relational databases. But Oracle and DB2 are the top leaders in relational databases, but we also cooperate a lot in other areas, and Oracle, especially as they've made more and more acquisitions, PeopleSoft and JD Edwards, it's critical to cooperate. And if somebody came, and we had lots of discussion, that's what Lou said that in senior management meetings, Lou, are they competitors or are they not? The answer is, it depends. Are they on the other side of the net and you're playing a game against them? That is, you're competing for business with a client. Then you want to take the ball and, shove it down their throat if you can. But, are you working with standard bodies on areas of mutual things? Then you hang out together. And it's really important. to be able to do this, and it takes emotional maturity. I say emotional maturity because, you know, it's really professional maturity, because you have to, on the one hand, really want to kill them. I mean, if you're competing for a $100 million relational database deal and they win, it's really painful. But if you say, the bastards, I'm not going to do business with them again, now you're cutting your nose. So that's why there is really no good answer. Now, that was not exactly your question, but framing a strategy to your advantage, in my mind, is a huge part of innovation. And again, you know, most of you are either engineers or honorary engineers for the purpose of this course. As we have said, it takes as much hard thinking to know how to do that as it does to solve a big signal processing problem with fast Fourier transforms. You know, you really need to put your brain and think through as if you were thinking about the toughest technical problem. And if you do that, and engineers are really good at solving complex problems, you usually will do very well. So, yes, and then we'll go here.
So it sounds like if I'm a disruptive guy, it sounds like
if you are a
disruptive technology, it sounds like my best philosophy should be to sort of either fly under the radar to like get big enough or partner with or complement the existing thing until I can take over.
That's a good one.
Example would be the batteries. They had these new hydrocell batteries.
Yes.
Get charged by whatever. But instead of saying, okay, you can charge a battery, you can run your laptop on it, they say you can charge the battery that you have. So if you're on the road and you need to charge a battery,
yeah,
just plug this in. But eventually they want to get rid of the door cells or whatever.
Yeah, and that's reasonable because, and by the way, both sides can know it, that this is a dating of convenience, because you're learning from them, and I'm assuming they are getting something from you, but they know, you know, you can part companies, and that's totally fine. Exactly. And the maturity is that you need to be comfortable with that. That, you know, it's just a very comfortable thing. And, you know, and I'm saying that because often when people especially are more junior, it's like, well, but how can I deal with the bastards? We have to, you know. And then especially within IBM, where different groups hate versus cooperate, they send email messages at midnight attacking. And trust me, I don't know if you've all gotten messages from some of your colleagues saying, how dare you do this? You're an idiot. These people are trying to kill me. And the answer is, well, that's it. I'm not playing tennis against them. We're actually doubles partners. Please.
So I'm taking up on the need to strike a balance between not falling in love with innovation,
yeah,
and doing that. So what kind of framework can we do? What kind of checks and balances can we do inside an organization to make sure that happens?
Well, it really gets down to having a very sober analysis of what cards you're holding. There's no substitute for that. And the cards will come, different kinds of cards. To be honest, the most important one, I think, is revenue and profit. The reason is the most important one is, if you run out of money, you can have the most beautiful strategy in the world, but you're going to die. I mean, you just will. And as I said, I think that happened to the old AT&T that couldn't, they called the right shots, but they took their eye off the ball of their legacy businesses, and as a result, remember, it's my opinion, somebody else may see it differently, they didn't have enough time to see the new strategies through. And remember, it's much easier to predict what will happen than how quickly it will happen. For example, let me take some concrete things and some different ones. So let's take virtual worlds. You'll know what I'm talking about. Second Life and lots of things. I am convinced, and so are a lot of people, that this is going to be a very big deal. But if you ask me how quickly, when will Remyo, I have no idea. Is it 2 years? Is it 1 year? Is it 5 years? I honestly have no idea. So it's important IBM is very involved, and I work hard to get us there, and I tell lots of companies to get on the learning curve. But I don't know when it will take off. That's an example. Most of what people said would happen during the height of the dot-com bubble, that we're building a digital economy and things like that, they're happening. It's just that those people said it would happen in, 2 years. The reality is you don't build a digital economy for the world in 2 years. It takes a while to do that. And because the new things are unpredictable, how quickly, and remember, part of how quickly will they start generating serious profits and cash, you need to rely on what you have now, and you need to plan so that you keep living off this while this is nurtured and growing. So cash is one. The other is talent. Do you have talented people that you can start moving into these areas, both technical people, management talent, and so on? And I've seen people do that. If you said, no, our existing people will just put on the legacy crap and let them do the money. We'll hire all new people to do the exciting stuff. That is not a good idea. You do want to acquire new talents, but the new talent usually have zero loyalty to the company. They don't even know the company. You cannot show up on day one and say, I love this company. That would be suspect. It's like you go on the first date and say, let's get married. That takes a little while to fall in love. And so you want some people that can start bringing the culture. And if you don't have anybody who knows anything about this area, then you're out of balance. Brand and history is extremely important. In fact, I just finished a conference call with Chris Wall, who is the person from O&M, Ogilvy & Mathers, that will come be the guest lecturer November 1st, and I'm really looking forward to what he's going to say, because he's an expert in brand and things like that. That is so important. And we talk quite a bit about major screw-ups we've seen, Ford fixed Jaguar. Jaguars used to have horrible engineering. Now they are very reliable. You all know what I'm talking about? Ford screwed up the Jaguar brand. Because Jaguar is a high-end brand, and they started developing low-end Jaguars on top of Ford chassis. Well, this is as if I tell you, okay, I'm going to give you Porsches on VW chassis. And VW is a very good car, but if you buy a Porsche, you want a goddamn Porsche. And if you start bringing Porsche to downscale, eventually you break the brand. Like people say, what the hell is a Porsche? I don't know anymore. And they did that to Jaguar. So you have to be very careful. Is what you're trying to do, does it fit the brand? And if it doesn't fit the brand, then you're probably better off having a totally separate company and managing as a totally separate company. So these are all the myriad of strategic decisions you need to make. And they take a lot of thinking. Again, and let me keep repeating, sometimes people say, well, you must be an MBA. Well, you can be an MBA, and I have a lot of respect for MBAs, but people who are really good with complex systems, when they put their mind to it, are superb at this, because these are god-awful complex problems. That's why I keep saying so much how we need more and more people with talented system skills, engineering skills, to be in major management positions leading these kinds of areas. So let's move and start talking about execution. And as a colleague of mine, Steve Mills, who runs IBM software business, says often, a strategy that you cannot execute is a fantasy. And fantasies are okay, but not in the business world. You know, then you really have a bad strategy. So let me start by talking about some of the questions that Clay Christensen and Michael Rayner have posed. And one of the major questions about executing a new strategy is to decide what are you going to do yourself and what do you want to partner for. Remember, this is really important for something new because you've built incredible skills here and you want to bring some of the skills to execute the new strategy. But by definition of new and disruptive, you probably don't have all the skills. And if you say, well, I'm going to take my time, build it up, you don't have time. So you need to decide partnering, acquisition, and so on. A key question, especially now more and more, is how about proprietary versus standard? And as you know, we're making those decisions more and more. This is fairly new in the IT world, actually in every engineering discipline goes through similar questions. So what do you build using standard components versus what should you build making it more proprietary? Automobiles, whatever you want to. And often it's very related to the first question. We'll talk about that. What's the dynamics? How do you gravitate between them? And you know, once you decide one way, are you stuck or do you often come back? So let's explore some of these questions that Christensen has posed. And as he said, the decisions about what to insource and what to procure from others has a huge impact on the chance of success for any new venture. I'd love to hear your thoughts on why you think that is. I agree totally, but why would you think that is? Basically what? Right. So where are you going to put efforts? Yes?
It's really about keeping the knowledge and the IP with your own company and outsourcing all the complementary tasks. As the next generation evolves, we need to have the knowledge in-house rather than giving it out to your partners.
But now, what if your partners have the knowledge you want?
Then you are in trouble.
Or you make them your partner.
Yeah, but there is no guarantee that they won't work with their competitors also. So.
Oh, no, no. You have to assume they will. But I'll get back with an example. Yes, go ahead.
I was thinking about Boeing, and for Boeing 787, the person who was in charge of that program had come here and given a talk.
At MIT.
And one of the things that they had mentioned is they made this massive decision for 787 that they're going to outsource a lot of things across the world. And, you know, one of their crown jewels, which is the wing development, they have given out. And one of the questions...
Who does at Japan, am I correct?
I think so. Japanese wing.
Yes.
Matsushita, I think.
Yeah.
And one of the questions was, you know, China, Brazil, and a bunch of others are developing their own jets, and would they learn? And one of... He actually said the same thing, which is, you know, they would never have been able to make the capital investments and ramp as fast to beat Airbus as they did with this. And they're already making an assumption over a certain time frame that people are going to absorb that knowledge. And is their skill really the heavy engineering aspect or just the system integration aspect? And so it's a difficult balance.
See, let me rephrase it and see if I got the gist, which is, you would say, everything else being equal, I want to do it all by myself, but what if that's impossible? Now, you have two choices. Either you say, then I'm not going to do it because I only do things I do by myself. And the second one is, I'm going to partner with other people. Then you say, well, you idiot, but the Chinese just want to partner with you to learn from you. The answer is, well, let me repeat. If I don't partner with them, and by the way, the Japanese, the Koreans, the Brazilians, it's not like the Chinese are particularly nefarious and everybody wants to learn and then go their own way. If you don't do that, then you don't play. That's why my feeling is that when you are in a leadership position, in a management position, if you keep thinking about the problem and thinking, and I don't just mean thinking, and you analyze and you ponder, once you get convinced this is the only way to get it done, then the decision is obvious because the alternative doesn't work. Now, you don't know that at the beginning, so often what happened through this process of thinking is you start deciding, do I have alternatives? What would be the alternatives? But, you know, once you've thought it through and this is the only way you're able to do that, it's like it's over. Somebody says, yeah, but, you know, real men are, yeah, but screw it. That was 50 years ago. Or do a product that is simpler. Don't do a 787, do a Cessna, you know. No, I want to do 78. Well, you cannot do that. And those are very interesting debates and discussions that you have to do. But then your point is extremely well taken, because once you say, well, I'm going to partner, then often what then happens is you start rethinking of your business at the next level, which is you are the best in serving the market, serving the airlines, and you know, we'll talk about it throughout. And these people may learn to make wings, maybe airplanes, but I'm not sure they'll learn how to have loyal customer relationships, or it will take longer. So it's very interesting things.
I think this question is at the very core of defining your company.
Yes.
You are different from your competitors.
Exactly.
And your suppliers. So basically, if you are designing, if you're making compilers and you're doing buying lots of other things, you have to know what is your core business.
Yes.
That makes you very different from everybody else.
Yes.
Right? So it's very important to know.
Yeah, it's very important to know. And remember, any changes over time. This is very important. Yes, I agree totally.
My question is, we're talking in terms of disruptive. So if you have a
have something that's brand new in the market, it's hard. My guess is you may not be able to partner with the best, and so the only option you may.
Say that again. You may not be able to partner.
You get partners. You may be able to get suppliers, say, making something new. So would you have, I mean, would there be any other choice but to in-source, meaning develop it yourself? Only when it comes to disruptive. I mean, there are other cases where.
Well, but usually not the whole thing is disruptive, one part. And so part of the thinking is, okay, so keep to yourself the jewel. And then there is usually, again, in engineering projects, there's a lot of, I was going to say crap, but that's not the right term. A lot of other important things that surround a system, a business, a product. And the more you know where is the jewel in that crown, the more you keep that to yourself. That's where you protect the IP like crazy. You may not even share that with your partners. You may say, the partnership stops here. You don't go into my bedroom. You know, you can come into the living room, but, you know, that's where you stay because there are certain things you're not willing to share, or there are partners and there are partners. And sometimes you say, you know, but if you invest $1 billion here, now it's different. And by the way, for example, IBM, we decided the fabs in Fishkill got too expensive and we needed to share the cost. Just got too expensive. The risk, not unlike Boeing's decision. In principle, Boeing could have done that, but now the risk is this high. You all know what I mean by a fab, where you build semiconductors. They are frightfully expensive. And so a number of companies, Samsung, Sony and others pay, you know, not just pay, they are partners. They pay, they co-own the facility. I don't know if they co-own it, but I don't know what the arrangement is.
Would you, aren't you not giving, when you share, like, that, you're also sharing a lot of the other information with your partner, so aren't you giving up?
You are.
So, I mean, for example,
gets back to Boeing. So do you want the fab or don't you want the fab? And the only way to have the fab is to partner.
And so cost is the only driver to go out, meaning?
No, because you now have to think of a business model that lets you stay in business with partners versus a vertically integrated business model. You have to rethink your business model. And if you cannot make the business model close, then you won't, you know, then you'll get eaten up by your partner. So you have to decide, is there, if your partner, let's assume, just one second, let's assume that your partner starts undercutting you. They learn from you, now they start undercutting you. Is there something better you can do from them? By the way, sometimes you make a mistake. You think I can, and before you know it, you're dead because your partner is much better than you. But at least you shouldn't die quietly. You should say, well, I think I can do better than them in a few. You know, this gets played out over and over. The Chinese cars, people say, well, sorry, nothing cars. And the Western companies, I'm sure the Japanese companies also, I don't know if Korean companies have business in China, but I'm assuming they do. To do that, you probably have to take Chinese partners. To do that, you say, what did they do it, even though they knew the partners are learning from them? Because China is a huge market. And if you don't partner, you don't get to play in the market. But just like the Japanese car companies, then the Korean car companies, is there any question that the Chinese car companies and the Indian car companies will start producing very good, high-quality cars over time? But, you know, that's the how can I say, that's the mating dance of business at some level. You're circling each other. Yes, please.
In this regard, the two important factors is the speed to market.
Yes.
And the cost advantage.
Yes.
Personally, from my experience, I was working in Siemens, but in 2002, 2003, we decided that core architecture would be Siemens and would outsource whatever is the best, first we'll get in the market and have the cost advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen that if you develop everything in-house, it might be you are lagging the market.
That's a very good point.
The first mover will always have some advantage, second mover, but if you're third mover, fourth
mover, you're dead.
So it's not necessarily that if you develop everything, you can be the first mover.
No, that's
so from
right.
From that point, you have a big advantage. Second point, I thought that from the cost advantage, I've seen that Siemens used to have for the telecom business their own Siemens Buddhist server.
Yes.
But if we find that we are under enormous cost pressure from IBM, from Oracle, from Sun. So what we decided that the way customer wants, we'll build it. The price, okay, if you choose this one, this is the price. If you choose IBM, this will be the price. If you Sun, this will be the price. So the customer has the option, and you can play with your computer with the cost advantage.
Mm-hmm.
So the speed to market and cost is...
They're very good. I think that's a very good point. And we'll get to speed to market when we now talk about modular components. Because, as you can imagine, that's another huge thing that comes. Yes, please?
I wanted to make some comments about the fab because I worked in the Fishkill fab before I came here.
Okay.
It's interesting. Like you mentioned, everything is shared. It's a partnership in the true sense. We share defect density, everything. You know, you can go in. But you also get information from your partner.
Yeah.
So you know, like half the world of fabs, you know, where they're at.
So that's very good.
So there is shared learning, that's one. The cost of developing a technology right now is $1 billion, it's going to $2 billion for every node, and the cost of a fab is doubling, it's $2 billion now, it's going to $4 billion. So there is no way we can even be in this market sustainably without that. And thirdly, we can build on businesses which normally would not have chosen us, would have chosen TSMC, because we just don't have the capacity. So a lot of businesses, for example, Xbox with Christmas, you have, you know, nothing up till November, then November, December, January,
that's right.
There is this big peak, and then there is nothing. And so if you're delayed by a month or so, you know, so you have to have multiple second
that's
sourcing.
Very good.
And the fact that we have, you know, all these virtual fabs helps us compete with TSMC. So we got our foot in the door in a lot of businesses which would not normally have considered us. And we have some similar cost structures, but when we go to market, a lot of times we have an order desk, which is one of these fabs, and you go, and typically the firm that wins the business has, you know, the right of first refusal. So if it cannot deal with it, then it can. So a lot of times our partners will also win business, and they can't handle it because of some other order.
I see.
So there is a lot of synergy there.
Yeah, but you said something. You said a number of very good things, but the first one I should have said, which is you pick your partners very carefully. And let's say Samsung is a partner, right? Samsung is a wonderful company, as you know. So you can say, well, Samsung will learn from you. Well, guess what? We learn from Samsung. Sony is a partner, right? Philips is a partner.
So we have ISIS and Asta. So IBM, Chartered, Samsung, Infineon is one. And then AMD, Sony, Toshiba is other.
How about the Boeing? Did they make that point also? So let's take the wing. You know, the Japanese are superb engineers, but, you know, the most incredibly disciplined engineers. So Boeing must be learning how the Japanese do this.
Yeah, I think their big thing was they were trying to hit this date. So it was primarily time to market and capital investment.
Yeah,
but
I should have mentioned that learning from your partners is critical. And really, and in fact, the reason I'm sticking to that so important is because the worst thing you can do is to have, let me use a colonial attitude toward your partner. Say, well, we need their money, and they don't know anything. What a mistake. Look at Detroit. So it's much better to say, oh my God, look what Samsung has done, which, I mean, it's incredible what they have done. How did they do it? And now you learn from them and so on. Or now more and more the Indian companies. I mean, look at what they've been doing. So how do they do that? So the learning is incredibly, but I cannot say enough. And this is especially important in global markets because often what happens, like everybody in the U.S. will more or less, they hire the same MBAs from the same, you know, Sloan and Harvard and Stanford, Wharton. So pretty much they look the same. And that's why often the real, totally different things are being done by people someplace else, China and India and Japan, and they do the business differently. And you can say, well, but they're different. You know? It's a lot they do that's much better that you forgot. And so in a global world, the learning by partnering with companies from very different regions is particularly important because they often bring tremendous management techniques that you never had before because that wasn't the Sloan way or the Harvard way, and now it should. So as Clay Christensen says, you know, so if it fits your core, do it. Otherwise, do it outside. But if you read the chapter, he and Rainer make the point that don't assume you're making a decision forever. Because often you're making the decision now, but often markets will change again and you may need to take it back. So make a decision for sure, but keep your mind open because you need to decide strategically. What that really says is, if you, what's the term? I forgot. If you, when you lose all your skills in an area, what's the term? De-skill yourself, but there's another term. If you lose all your skills in an area because you have decided to outsource, be very careful because if in the future you may decide to re-enter it, you lost all your skills. And in fact, one of the things that often happens in competition is your competitor will want you to get rid of all your skills in an area, and they can even do that by selling you stuff very cheaply until you have no more skills, and then you're in trouble. So it's just something to watch out for. Please. Yeah, but again, sometimes you totally outsource. Other times, like let's say BMW, I believe the X3 they don't manufacture, but the X5 they do. You know, those are SUVs, and so maybe there is a balance point that now. For some things, you said, well, we outsource the cafeteria. Should we retain some chefs? You know, sometimes you say that is not a core competency. No, I'm being very serious. You know, once upon a time, companies were so well integrated that they had their own cafeterias and their own people. Most companies now have outsourced that, but they don't need to retain. They need people in procurement who understand how to negotiate with the best and so on, but otherwise they don't need that. Manufacturing, marketing, you just have to be a little more careful because it's so core to so much of what you do that you have to be careful. And again, this is the warning that Raynor and Christensen give, that if you want to go back and you have you just get rid of it altogether, it's going to be very difficult to go back. And sometimes you do want to go back, whereas if you've retained it at a certain level, it becomes easier to now expand that. Now, let's talk about... So we talked about this. The next major decisions, which is really vertical integrated designs, proprietary vertically integrated designs versus modular designs. It's a huge, huge, huge decision. And then I thought Chapter 5 had a very good discussion of vertical integration versus modular, and sort of when do you use vertical integration, which is interdependent architectures, and when do you use modular? And as you know, he gives a very good definition of vertically integrated ones and what you're optimizing for, but by definition of proprietary, you're committing yourself to pretty much do it all, versus when it's modular, which is much more, you can distribute it more, then you're relying on other people more. It becomes easier to decompose it in time to market. Please.
There's two things I would like to bring up. As I was reading this, the word performance jumped out at me.
Yes.
And the reason why, if you ask anyone in this room, their definition of performance is going to be different. So as far as performance, how does Christensen define performance? Because performance for me, I mean, I do a lot of graphics, so I need a graphics card that has much more memory.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but the new types of performance is, like, for instance, let's look at the iPhone. Someone can look at the iPhone and say, okay, this performs well because it has an interface and it has, I mean, something that drives the aesthetic value.
I don't think that's what he meant.
Okay, but I mean, but it's...
I agree violently with...
Performance is being redefined.
That's right.
You know, so
that's,
it's like,
right.
So what are we targeting our market? I mean, what markets are we targeting?
No, you're bringing up, and we'll discuss it much more. I think when Christensen is talking about performance, he's talking about sort of classic product performance, speed, reliability, and things like that. The kinds of performance where you need to carefully control different components. For example, if the iPad, in order to run, needed a custom micro and custom memory and custom storage, you know, it could have been, then whoever is designing the iPad probably had to design all these components at the same time. By the way, in the old days, that's how we did computers. The PC was probably the first time that those things got disaggregated. But before, you know, you did mini computers, you did it all. Everybody did it all pretty much because the components were of a quality that you gave away too much performance and quality if you didn't do it yourself, and the stuff, because of the immaturity, you couldn't do that. But you're bringing out an incredibly important point, and we'll talk about it in a second, that once you get to the level of good enough components, other criteria need to take over. Otherwise, you're spending money on something that your clients could care less about. You can say, well, maps on the iPhone take a second, and in my machine take 0.2 seconds. Well, you know, people, but, you know, but of course you need to learn assembly language to deal with my maps instead of, you know, whatever you do with the iPhone. That's a simple trade-off.
And in addition to that, he never, I guess he never explains or talks about the design component.
No, I understand.
Because if you talk about interdependent architecture and modular architecture,
yes,
you're compromising a lot when you talk about modular architecture. You're compromising design. There's a lot of, because if you look at, if you take modular out of the context of technology, let us look at modular in the context of architecture, for instance. When you talk about modular design in architecture, I mean building architecture, you're compromising a lot as far as the aesthetics of it. So modular compromises.
Wait, and you're an architect, so
yes,
you know a lot about this.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it depends what we mean by modular. Because
it's component architecture, right?
Yeah. But no. But I mean is, let me sort of go to an extreme. So let's take the Prue Tower. And if I ask you how much of what goes into the Prue Tower are standard things in the building ecosystem. You know, steel and bricks, all that is standard. Am I correct?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm.
So, no, but those are modular components. Don't underestimate. So that's why I say it depends what we mean. Now, modular, I think modular components is what we call a fractal concept. I don't know if you all know about fractal, which is, at any level you look at it, you will find a similar problem. Remember, once upon a time, there may have been building contractors that had their own steel factories and did custom steel for their building. That must have, I bet you that happened once upon a time, or they asked you a steel to do them a certain kind of steel. You no longer need to do that. But, I mean, what would you say in a building like the Prue Center is custom versus standard components?
As far as the design component of it?
Well, by design components.
You talk about glass and steel. I mean, if back to what you talk about component issue, if you boil it down to components, I mean, steel is steel.
No, but that's important, and glass is glass, right?
Yes.
No, but that's very important.
But it's how you cut the steel.
I agree. I agree. But so my point, and this is incredibly important for business systems. I bet you, and I wish I had quantification of this, that 90% of what goes. I don't know how much the Prue Center costs. Let's assume it cost $1 billion. I bet you between 80 and 90% of that cost was based on standard components, and the amount that is custom is 10 to 20%. That's my feeling, that in mature engineering disciplines, and what I'm saying applies to automobiles and so on, the majority of the pieces are components, and the design, how you assemble them, and unique things that you do, and unique things that you hire expert people to do for the first time for you, is a relatively smaller percentage. That's my expectation. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, but I guess my argument is still impacts the design result.
It totally.
And you compromise the design based on your components.
Well, yes, I agree. But remember, you also have a budget and a time to market. Just a second. We'll take everybody. Because, no, this is an incredibly important discussion, incredibly important because I believe that every discipline starts doing their own steel and glass. And then it takes forever to do that, you know, like cathedrals were pretty custom, right? But, you know, eventually it becomes an engineering discipline. And part of becoming an engineering discipline, one of the major pieces is the notion of modular components. I think the Industrial Revolution, a major step was the introduction of standard components. You all know what I'm talking about with the, I think it may have been the Winchester, you know, rifles that could be assembled. And if you look at, the, you know, mechanical engineering, civil engineering, they all start developing a discipline based on standards and standard components, and then the tremendous uniqueness is design at multiple levels. So I'm agreeing violently with you that it's no longer in the components, it's in the design. That's what I'm saying. Immature disciplines spend too much time in the components and not enough in the design. That's my feeling. And the reason I find this so fascinating, and then we'll get back to all the discussions, is that if you look at business as an engineering discipline, which I know people we haven't, it is perhaps the most immature of all. You notice that every goddamn company reinvents the processes for running the business. You say, well, why do you do that? Well, because that's a business. You cannot build this business using somebody else's steel. Now, that's changing. That's where business process. So, you know, it's beginning to change, but boy, is it. That I view that to be, this is my opinion, the mother of all disruptive innovations in the 21st century is how business is transforming, becoming more distributed, more deconstructed, which then brings into business design, which is what you really want to have. And business design and business strategy, in my mind, are totally intertwined. So that's why I was probing so much, because I think design is really, really, really critical. It's really, really critical. In fact, I would say it's everything. Yes, go, let me ask Sunyu to comment first.
So I guess the first thing that you were trying to mention was that the trade-offs between modular design and interdependent design, which I think you guys are mostly aware of, because
right.
You guys are from the system dynamics. And what he brought about was the interaction, a world trade-off between the design, which is more like an aesthetic design, and then the architecture of it, right? Mm-hmm. So I think from my experience, I talked to a lot of people from Samsung and LG and these Korean electronics companies, which is a similar structure with Apple, right? So they're making this electronic stuff, which I think the core of the competition has shifted from engineering problem solving into more like a design.
I agree violently.
Aspect.
Violently.
And what they changed was that these industrial designers, like who designs the form factor, not the function factor, they are getting more and more importance in their organization.
Yes.
So what they do is they usually, I mean, like 10 years before, LG and Samsung didn't really concern about this aesthetic aspect. So what they did was their research centers and the product development
teams,
they started the initiation of the product development.
I agree.
So they came up with nice functionalities and you know, features and things like that. And then they thought about how to wrap it up.
Right.
But now they are getting more, these design industrial designers, they are getting more importance.
I couldn't agree with you more. In fact,
same for Apple as well.
In fact, let me tell you, one of the projects that I've seen recently that I'm most excited about is a project in the UK called Design London that Gordon Brown has initiated. He initiated when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, and I'm involved with Imperial College, and I was there in July and learned about it. Now, Design London is a partnership of three institutions. Two are what you would expect: Imperial College School of Engineering, Imperial College School of Management. Right? That's what you would expect. The third is the RCA, the Royal College of Arts, which I'm sure you would say it's one of the world's best design schools. Am I correct? So the fact that they are an equal partner is what makes this so innovative, that they have a school of design equal partner with engineering and management, precisely for all the reasons we're discussing. Yeah, you had a comment in the back. Yes, please.
Yeah, I was going to find an analogy in civil engineering and software, excuse me. In civil engineering, about 20, 30 years back, bridges were created on-site in situ. And
yes.
Recently, you've seen that prefabricated and pre-stressed concrete kind of arrangements and panels have increased the construction of bridge time to maybe less than a year,
mm-hmm.
which is really fabulous.
Yes.
Now, even the aesthetics of prefabricated bridges are yes. kind of better. That's one. Second advantage is, since the prefabricated panels are created in industries and not on-site, you have better advanced composite materials that are used
mm-hmm.
to create them.
Yes.
So from a reliability perspective, from
yeah, perfect. I understand.
Market, it's a perfect scenario where
yeah.
things have changed drastically over decades.
Yes,
if
that's
you,
perfect.
Now, if you compare this to software architecture, open source has come up a lot, and it has allowed people to work in smaller groups and create small products, and then modular products. And if you interface them and create
perfect.
A larger product, you have a quicker time to market.
Yes.
You have better reliable products because each of them is
yes.
individually tested, and you have cost.
No, but you also brought up something very important, which is a comparative advantage. Who did that? Schumpeter? Who talked about comparative?
Porter
also, which is once you can deconstruct it. Oh, I'm sorry. The one who first probably brought it up was Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, which is that you start specializing. So to your point, if you're a bridge builder and you are also building, I don't know, steel or cables, whatever, you may be a superb bridge builder, but a medium rate steel builder. But if you're working with another company that only does steel, they may be world class in steel. So now if you bring your design skills, your project management skills, with their composite, whatever, the quality, the world's quality goes up. Adam Smith actually first formulated this principle in The Wealth of Nations. And then, through the ages, Roland Coase and Schumpeter and others, which is very, very important. And that's why if somebody said, well, I prefer to compete this way, the penalties eventually become extraordinary. So you have a good advantage initially, but eventually, as you pointed out, it's very difficult. You had a...
I guess it's a point about the architecture argument just then. I mean, we talked in our last class on system architecture.
Yes.
We have an architect coming in, and he stresses a lot how...
In the last class...
system architecture, and what he talks about is how traditional.
You mean like a civil engineer?
It's a real architect who came in and
okay.
he designed.
Okay.
Children's Museum.
Okay.
And so he talked a lot about how traditional architecture deals with form follows function.
Yes.
Like you as an architect need to understand what kind of functions you deliver,
yes,
and
yes,
then you put a formula on it.
Yes.
And that's the same for a lot of engineering stuff, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Promise and afterthought. For in the past, there's, but right now, what he talks more about is like, there's an intertwine between form and function. You can't just do one.
I agree totally.
And in fact, when you look at the Christensen tradition, Christensen curve, right? Like, there's this disruptive innovation and all this, like how performance keep going up. And then a lot of companies actually now start to have a surplus in capacity because now they reach their certain point.
Exactly.
And where do they compete in? A lot of them compete in form.
Exactly.
Like beauty, like, rather than the function.
No, that's, I agree violently. But you see, perfect, I agree. Let me take please.
I wanted to give another example of the trade-off that you talked about between performance and modular. So I used to work in chip design and specifically in application-specific design, so we had different
yes.
components that IBM designed, and we also designed our own memory
mm-hmm.
designs. And it was all customized, so it was really high performance. One of the things we did is we changed the architecture of our system to put all these things together to get third-party IP. And when we made that change, we had the option of, you know, making it modular and accepting third party drastically reduced performance. And but the fact was you could now have like tens of companies make
exactly.
things. And a lot of times each of these designs are optimized for various applications. So while the putting together of the thing reduced the performance, the fact that these memories were
yeah.
optimized increased it, and plus we were able to go after a much broader section of the market which we otherwise wouldn't have been able to.
Yeah, yeah. Please.
Okay, the last slide, we talked about the decision to in-source and outsource, right?
Yes.
And in this slide, we talk about architecture. Can I say if we choose to outsource, so then we have to use modern architecture?
Yes, I would say that. I mean, sometimes you might, otherwise it's really risky because if it's proprietary but you're just contract, otherwise it's more contract hiring somebody. Whereas, in fact, the modular architectures facilitate building an industry ecosystem. Because also most companies that you would outsource to, most companies don't want to be trapped by you. And so if it's standard, then they have multiple clients themselves. And especially if they are the best companies in the world in that, then, you know, those are some of the trade-offs. Let's talk a little bit about, again, just very quickly, I'm just summarizing some of what the chapter says, that the proprietary vertically integrated systems or products are clearly what you do in the early stages. You just don't know what you're doing. You haven't had the chance to deconstruct it yet. So that's what you need to do. And usually that's what lets you do the product, but you have to invest a lot yourself. You're taking a lot of risk, and it takes a while because you need to do all these other things. And at that point, you are vertically integrated and you control all the pieces. When you start moving to modular, open, flexible architecture, usually that requires a certain level of maturity because what you're saying is most of the components, not all, most, are good enough, which means, as you pointed out, from, you know, if you keep making them, you know, it's like, if you say, well, no, screw the iPad. I'm going to keep doing a better micro. Well, people who buy iPads, the micro is good enough. Or for most laptops, the micro is good enough. So just continuing the emphasis on the micro, you are overshooting the market. So that's the point when you say, I can go with standard components, and then things begin to disaggregate and you start building ecosystems. And this is what most disciplines do. And now the question comes, which should you do? And it all depends, is really the only answer, which is for the new things that you are innovating by yourself, the really new pieces. You know, in architecture, you know, maybe an architect has an idea for an incredible new window, and they do the specs and get a company to do it for them, and for a while they are the only ones who have it, and that's a custom window, and that makes the whole building, you know. A few of those are totally fine. In fact, a few, and people do that, am I correct? That you may have some absolutely things, but, you know, if that same architect says, you know, and my toilets are also, you know, eventually your client runs out of money. You say, no, I need special toilets and I need, you know. So you have to pick, am I not correct? There are a few things that may be the unique differentiators and the rest you get from your ecosystem. And I'm assuming if you're a really good contractor or a really good, let's say Toyota is famous for this, your partners are so good that they bring you their innovations. So you can, you know, you don't need to do new toilets. Whoever does toilets for you brings you the best toilets in the world, so that's what you're using now. Please.
For example, I think actually Steve Jobs working on the store in Manhattan on Fifth Avenue redefined the window system and patented.
Redefined
the window system that he had. The caulking was actually outside.
You don't mean redefine windows?
No, the window system. The
okay.
System that
he had.
Not,
I was like, wow, that would be.
No, the actual physical window system.
The store?
Of the store.
I never heard that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How so?
The caulking was actually outside and not concealed enough, and he did not want to be seen from the outside. So he said, hey, you have to get rid of this caulking. You have to do something about it. Why don't you just put it inside? And he's like, okay, you cannot do that because it's a rain sealant. But he said, you have to come up with something. So he got people to do it, and it redefined how it looked, and now you cannot see the sealant from outside. So it's like pushing the envelope mm-hmm. based on the design factor.
Yeah. And then... You know, other people concentrate on the architectural dimension. And remember, this gets back to, in my mind, it all gets back to design, in my mind. That the reason this is so important is because I'm convinced that in the knowledge age we're in now, because the components we have to work with are so good, the incredible competition is design and its form, you know. But now, this is what gets so interesting. Classically, we apply design to physical things, whether it's an iPad or a BMW 3 Series. But how about, let's say, a customer service in a business. Could you think of customer service from the point of view of design? And apply similar criteria of, I'm assuming in one of the things in design have to be you put yourself in the shoes of the people looking at the design, correct? So in customer service, you put yourself in the shoes of the person receiving the customer service. And as we know, a lot of times when you do that, you say, oh, you know, it's amazing anybody does business with us. because we do such a poor job. But the reason this is so important is because the industry, business, I mean, again, if you think of business as a system, we're building cathedrals. I don't know how else to say it. We are in the cathedral stage of businesses. And the biggest opportunity that I see is the ability to start taking this into the future by systematically doing certain processes far better than anybody else. And now the reason we might have a chance to do that is because this notion of modularity are now beginning to show up in business processes. Remember, before you didn't have technology. Remember, you needed the internet. You needed the SOA. You know, there's a whole set of things that you needed to start getting a certain level of modular business components, but they are beginning to show up. And part of them showing up is just like with the iPad and with the Boeing 787, if you can free up the people at the master architects, I don't know what, business architects, from having to do every goddamn thing, then they can start focusing on a few unique advantages and partner for the other. Remember how new this all is. This is barely happening now. So the opportunities for business to move from here to here, I think, are enormous. I don't know how you all feel about that, but I think that's the, in my mind, this is my feeling. In the 21st century, that's the game. And let me, before we take the break, let me give you one example. I think I already mentioned it once, but let me give it again, which is, Sunil Mittal, who is the chief of Bharti. And Bharti now is a conglomerate. I mean, they are a big conglomerate, but they are also the biggest private sector cellular company in India, growing by leaps and bounds. And Sunil Mittal said, I needed to grow fast. I didn't have enough energy to worry about all the other stuff. So he outsourced everything except customer acquisition and retention. That's what he did. He said, that's it. That's my unique window. It's the customer acquisition and retention. And to do that, he got, I believe, Ericsson and somebody else to do the network, and IBM is doing the computers, and other people are doing other stuff, which he said, I heard him personally give a talk at an IBM CEO conference. He said when he did this, everybody else in the telecom industry thought he was crazy, that how can you be a telco without owning your network? They thought, you don't know what you're doing. He said, well, the network is a commodity. Network is a commodity. Nobody had ever thought that you can be a telecommunications company and not own the network. Nobody ever thought of that. He reshaped the definition of a telecommunications company in terms of customers. He just went out and did it in terms of the customers. And would you all agree, Sunil Mittal is very, very successful. And I think that's a very good example of what I expect to see more and more in business innovation in the 21st century, precisely because we're moving from here to there. Now, here is the problem, and this here is where you all come in, which is, don't forget that in order to design 787s, chips, buildings, bridges, you use really sophisticated tools. You all know that, right? You know, EDA tools, CAD/CAM tools, all kinds of tools, and you do a lot of simulation, right? Massive simulation. Where are the tools for business design and simulation of different strategies? Where are they? And the answer is somebody has to invent them. You know, it's a little bit of work in that. So none of this can happen, because if what you say, oh, now that it's modular, you'll have people with drafting paper, you know, architecting fidelity. It doesn't work that way. We really need sophisticated tools, and that's all ahead of us, and, you know, we'll talk more about it, but let's take a break now, and then we'll continue in 10 minutes. Before we get to, so what did we do in IBM in operationalizing a business and go through some of the items, let me talk about how I've been, you know, when I'm talking about one of some of the biggest changes going on in innovation, what I tell people, which very much is the evolution of systems, is the way I think about it. But remember, I have a very expanded view of systems that are pushing us to have to keep moving into this dimension, the architectural design dimension, more and more. And let me talk about this in two critical dimensions. And then I'll tell you the third dimension that I usually add that I didn't include here. So one of the dimensions is breadth and scope. Now, let me tell you what I mean by that and illustrate it with IT systems. When I first started working with computers in the 1960s, I was first in college and then a graduate student in Chicago, a system was just the computer and the way it was connected to its I/O gear. That was the system. So it was very much just the piece of technology that was isolated. We never thought of it as isolated. We thought of it as wonderful new stuff because you can do a lot of calculations. But, you know, you brought your deck of cards. Then I usually went off to have a pizza downtown at Uno's, came back, got the results. Remember, oh, God, I forgot a comma in Fortran, so had to resubmit it. You're too young to remember.
I remember that,
yeah. You use punch cards?
Yeah, I'm 43.
Wait a second. When did you use?
At the academy, we still had a door.
Okay, so it was a history course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in 1962.
I've seen
5-inch discs. I'm sorry? What did you say, I'm sorry?
I have seen 5-inch discs.
But in 1962, when I was entering college, well, that was it. The interactive terminals didn't show up until late 60s, early 70s, text terminals, and then cathode ray tubes showed up in the 70s. But before that, it was cards. But then the notion of a system changed radically over the next 20 years with the rise of networks, local area networks, wide area networks. It was a much more bigger view of systems, and people could talk about, for example, banking systems with ATM terminals. Remember, those showed up in the 70s, were the first, I don't remember, you don't remember, but you must have read about it. In the first ATMs appeared in the 70s, connected over proprietary networks like IBM's system network architecture, manufacturing systems. So people started looking more specialized systems. Now, and this is very important. No question this is totally proprietary. I mean, this was almost the essence of functional, you know, performance guiding everything. And here, it was all pretty proprietary because networks were totally new, so they were proprietary. Systems received an incredible boost when the internet and the web got adopted in the mid-90s. Because for the first time, for the very first time, you can connect your clients to your systems. Remember, before the browser, you can only interact with your systems if you were inside the company through very specialized applications like ATMs or through some proprietary things that led you, you know, if you were a partner, you had maybe a special PC that led you in. If in 1994 you wanted to find out where your FedEx package was, and if you were a normal person as opposed to, let's say, a business that did a lot of business with them, you had to call a rep, and the rep typed into the proprietary network the number of the package. It went into its transaction system on the mainframe. It got back the answer, and the rep told you. For large customers, they would install a special PC with special software, proprietary, that linked you directly so that you essentially can be viewed by their system as if you were the rep. The browser, the web, revolutionized that because now everybody was using a browser. And everybody could connect to a web server. And now the web server, all it was doing initially was almost play the role of the operator that took your call. So you typed it in the browser. It went to the web server. The web server said, oh, this is a request to the mainframe. A little bit of software went there, got you back the answer, and said, God, this is magic. But it was a massive expansion. And in fact, the reason the bubble became a bubble is because it felt like magic, that the standards could let you do so much. I remember in the mid-90s, maybe 96, 97, I was in Japan. I had flown in, arrived. I flew in, must have been a Saturday, out of here, landed in Japan Sunday evening, and then woke up like 3 a.m., 4 a.m., Monday morning in Japan. And I remember there was a baseball game back in New York, Yankees or Mets, I don't remember, that I was very interested, but obviously you wouldn't get it in Japan. And then I remember that, oh, but my PC is connected to the internet. They were beginning to link the games over PCs, so I could be drinking green tea at 3 a.m. in my room in Japan, listening to the baseball game back here. Now, today, that is like, you know, why are you telling me this? But when it first happened, it was magic, and it was this deconstruction of the system. That's the only way I can say that. Now, where we are heading is that we really want to take every single aspect of a business and integrate it together. Every single aspect of a business. You say, well, what do you mean by that? Well, a business has processes, information, people, and now we have, you know, all the work on standards, SOA, of course, the internet. We can begin to couple them together. So you can begin to look at the business as a system. But now, once you start thinking that way, you realize, wait a second, there is no business that doesn't exist within an industry ecosystem. So if this is going to be useful, your definition of a system has to include the industry ecosystem. Because otherwise, I mean, if you say everybody inside the company can work with you, but the people making the wings of the Boeing have to make phone calls, it's all over. So you have to stretch what you're doing to all your suppliers and all your partners. And because more and more industries like healthcare are a mix of different industries. There's the hospitals, the doctors, the insurance companies, and others. That's what's driving the digital economy, that we're trying to look at all these things as a business. Now, the technology to help us start doing that, you know, it's beginning to happen. I mentioned several times more and more the internet, broadband, wireless, even software standards, SOA. The really hard question is, who the hell is designing this? Now, if you said to me, well, Irving, biology. No, this is not biology. You know, remember, in biology, yes, you designed this, but, you know, you cannot, if you're the CEO of a company, you cannot go to the shareholders and they say, how come you lost the records of all your clients? And you say, well, you know, shit happens in, we got a virus, everybody knows in biology. You cannot do that. Somebody has to design, an architect, and that gets back to the question, how do we do that? I mean, and by the way, there's no answer. I think this is, remember, for a long time, planes and cars, there were drafts, people drafting by hand, right? And I'm assuming for a long time, civil engineering, you know, architects were drafting by hand. It's only later that the tools came in and the simulations. In business, remember, who designs it? I don't know who designs it. It's a fascinating question. I don't know. Sung-Yu, is there a secret course in Sloan on designing business processes? And the reason, by the way, is that the whole notion of designing business systems, it's so new. I think it's really pushing us. But why do we not have a choice? Because of the scope. The complexity here is such that if you don't have some kind of design on top of that, and in fact, we'll get to this in a second, the notion of architecture that you apply to these incredibly complex systems has to be more flexible and adaptable than the notion of architecture that you use for a much simpler product. But I guess you would say the notion of architecture and an incredibly large microprocessor with huge number of things has to be more flexible and adaptable than just a small one. It gets back to modularity. Sung-Yu?
Just remember, there's two professors who are related to this. So one is Steve Effinger, who are trying to, I'm pretty sure you guys are familiar with Steve Effinger's work. Yeah. He's trying to reduce the complexity of the architecture
right.
and use it as an organization
right.
kind of
framework.
And the other one is Tom Malone.
Exactly.
Sort of make a primitives of these processes, which is a very small unit of processes, and trying to use it as sort of, you know, how to build more complex.
Yeah, I agree totally. Steve Eppinger and Tom Malone are sort of leading the way. But remember, how many professors are there in Sloan? These are two out of... You know, this is all very... By the way, this is... At some point, engineering started coming into the cathedral. I think we're sort of seeing that. Yes?
I think it was Murphy. I think it was just said that if you look out 20 years, 20 to 30 years on the macro economy, things will sort of shift down into buckets, if you will. The first bucket will be that Americans will continue to be the innovators. The Chinese will be the blue-collar workers of America. And the Indians will be the white-collar workers of America. And I think at the heart of all of that...
Who said that?
I think it was Murphy at Infosys. I'm trying to remember, but someone said that.
I wonder if he really believes that, or was trying to lull the Americans to sleep.
I think, though, if you do believe that if you look at the innovation side of America, at the heart of all that, the principle, is going to be mass customization.
No, I understand. I understand totally. I just want to say that, let's say, if you go to Tsinghua University and you say, you know, you guys are the blue-collar workers, Tsinghua is a really superb university in Beijing or Pekin or Shaodan. Actually, India needs to do much better at the high end of but I think you all know that. But if you go to China and then India, hopefully, as universities, the theory, I've been asking my Indian friends, why is it like that? And they say, for whatever reason, the Indian universities still cannot pay faculty, top faculty, enough to attract them.
They were public. Most of the good universities in India are public universities, funded by the government. But even then, they do not have large control in the technical domain. They have probably salary-wise, they do have large control.
So I don't know, but you know, everybody knows. Indian, you know, that's why most Indian students go to the U.S. to get PhDs. Am I correct?
The high end.
What I'm talking about, the high end. In China, Shaodan, wouldn't you agree with me? They are becoming world class, is my opinion. So I'm just saying, any U.S. executive that really believes that is in trouble. That's all I'm saying, because
let's take it out of context.
By the way, I agree totally with you, and in fact, it's an interesting discussion to have. Let me go to the next section, and then we'll talk about that, because it's a very interesting discussion. Let me now, I've talked about breadth, let me now go in the vertical dimension, my view of systems, and I'll explain the shapes later. But if you look at a stack, so we start with the technology components, microprocessors, memories, and you know, those are, we know how to do those fairly well. We have tools, deterministic stuff, and so on. And then we use these to build products, hardware and software products. And again, we pretty much know how to do that. And as you know, this, once upon a time, the technology and the products, I'm talking in IT now, were very proprietary, very unique. That was the competition. But as you know, more and more, a lot of these are totally commoditized, like DRAMs, HDDs, a lot of microprocessors. And even here, you can see standardization beginning to show up. And I think as SOA takes hold, that will happen more and more. But, you know, you can see the rise of Linux and other things. I think that what's happening is that the action is going up the stack. And one of the major things is the design of applications using technologies and products, which keeps expanding more and more and more and more. because as these things keep getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and more powerful and more reliable, there is more and more you can do in brand new areas. And then even more is to now use all this stuff to help companies build business systems, do it for companies, aggregate it. What's interesting when I look at the systems of the stack, what goes on down here and what goes on up there is very different. Systems, as you go down, they are deterministic. They are physical things. You know exactly what you're dealing with. You know, it's like you're building a microprocessor, you're building a bridge, you're engineering, designing physical things. As you go up the stack, you are designing market-facing systems that involve people and that involve people dealing with each other, and that renders them unpredictable. And when I say unpredictable, I mean emergent in a biological sense of unpredictable. Things are very complicated and very fast changing. You don't have control over them. They are emergent. Now, does that mean you cannot apply technology? No, of course. You can apply a lot of technology, but you now apply, it's dynamic instead of static. You're now applying, when you're dealing with dynamic systems, you have to constantly be watching them. Otherwise, they'll get away from you. You have to constantly be monitoring them. Let's take customer service. Somebody said, well, customer service is deterministic. When a client calls, I'll say, I'm programmed to answer one of these five questions. What if a client has a sixth question? Well, I'm not programmed to answer that. Guess what you have? You have a very unhappy client. That's an example of a market-facing system that is unpredictable because you cannot control what your clients are going to want from you. And think of a healthcare system. Think of systems to help nurses, doctors. So the design, and this is why I like the thinking of design, the architecture and design of systems at these higher levels with unpredictability have to be far more frameworked. I think it has much more, it's almost like urban planning rather than physical building. Now, I don't know if they teach urban planning in schools of architecture. Do they do that? They teach?
At least in some schools, I remember in my undergrad days.
But there is you all have to agree, there is it's architecture of a different sort when you think of urban planning. And so when you start doing business systems, now, what's so exciting is that before there was nothing we could do, so everything, for the most part, as you go up, you have to do it with labor. Because you say, well, if it's unpredictable, it's all people and labor. And guess what? As we get better and better and better, the industrial sector of the economy is smaller and smaller and smaller, and the services sector of the economy keeps growing. In most countries like the U.S., the U.K., it's over 70-80% of the economy. Also, more and more businesses, if you look at IBM, over 55% of IBM's revenue is now services, but that's true of almost every business because in these areas, they keep applying automation and technology, and those areas is labor. What is changing is with tools and collaborative systems, you can now begin to attack the labor part of those systems, the people-oriented part. When I say attack, I mean make people more productive, not by automation, but by giving them better and better tools. And in my opinion, the hardest part in all this gets back to design. Who is architecting, designing? How much knowledge do you need to do by industry vertical? Healthcare, investment banking, you know, and so on. And the answer, I believe, is going to be very vertical for quite a while. Let me explain this shape, because the first time I did this was to go to Washington to talk at some government thing where people were saying, you know, there are no jobs in technology, or there were the question, all technology, it's bad to be a technologist because all jobs are going on. And my hypothesis is every one of these levels, the requirement goes up by an order of magnitude. So for every one person doing this, you have 10 people doing that, and then you have 100 people doing that, or 1,000 people doing that. So if your definition of technology is down here, you know, designing microprocessors, you better put up what I tell people, David Ortiz kinds of numbers. You have to be a really, really good microprocessor design because we don't need that many. The competition is very, very strong. And more even at the product level, the more mature industries, the less people you need. Also, the more you learn, the more it gets automated. The bulk of the jobs are in application systems and then in business systems. Just to give you a view, in IBM, I just came back from an IBM Academy of Technology meeting, there are maybe 30,000 people doing this stuff in labs, and there are maybe 120,000, 140,000 people up there. And by the way, IBM has really good labs, so it's just the action is in the marketplace, and that's where the jobs are. And this stuff is infinitely more complicated. I mean, you put together the previous slides I show, which is, you know, the scope of the systems that we try to design with the fact that we can now attack systems at this much more market-facing, people-oriented level. And, you know, this is, it's pretty interesting. In ESD, in IBM's, in MIT's Engineering Systems Division, we're trying to put together some pretty nifty healthcare system initiatives because we can begin to try to attack healthcare as a systems problem because there is so much we can bring, although it's a very, very complicated problem. So now, once you talk about things of the scope I'm talking about, the question of modularization versus vertically integrated disappear, because you just cannot possibly do things of this scope if they are not standard-based and modular. You just can't. Somebody say, well, why is the internet standard? Well, it's like almost asking, why is biology built out of standard components? Which, you know, it is. You know, cells, DNA, it's pretty standard. And it's because that's the only way you can scale to the complexity we're trying to scale. So we'll see where all this goes. Now I'll move on to the specific implementations of a business in IBM. But any questions before that?
So you were saying that there are not many systems which actually do the business process management? Or
But there have been, right from 80s, you have CRM systems and business process engineering. Now, BPM seems to be the...
They're primitive. That's the way I would say. You know, the people are doing them, ERPs. You know, we have ERP systems, but I think they are, they work. If you give them a grade by form, you would give them a minus 10. That is, I don't know how many of you are familiar with ERP systems. And would you agree that most people are not very happy with them?
They work, yeah.
Yeah, they work. That would be as if we were talking about, well, look, I know this building looks horrendous, but it won't fall down. But it really looks horrendous. ERP systems, would you agree, they sort of have that quality?
They all have, I mean, you have to know what they're capable of, and then you can ask them whatever you need to. They'll give you a reasonable answer.
It's the foundation, right?
Yeah,
foundation doesn't have to be very pretty.
No. The foundation doesn't have to be pretty, but remember, you need to do something. You need to do interior decorating. So where is that? And so I think what's happening is the end users are dealing with the foundation. As a foundation, it's wonderful. But there is no... There is nothing above the foundation, nothing good about above the foundation. You know, that's okay. I mean, when I say that's okay, I mean that's an opportunity for all of you to go do some innovative stuff and invent new things and make systems that are much better, taking advantage of all the advances in technologies. But what we have today is very, very primitive. Because of the lack of form, the lack of that, again, it's the they are not people oriented. They are foundational oriented, not people oriented. Would you agree with that for the most part? I mean, look at Windows. You know, Windows works. I mean, we use it, but there aren't too many people that say, "Oh my God, do I love my Windows system?" I mean, I'm sure there are people who say that, but Bill Gates, you know, but it's just, you know, now why is that? Well, when was Windows designed? Windows was designed in the late 80s. Look at the advances in microprocessor technology, storage technology, everything else since the late 80s. Let's take user interfaces. The reason I'm so excited about virtual worlds, which comes from game playing and so on, is I think that's the biggest advance since the GUI. Do you know when the GUI was designed?
Xerox, the 70s.
Yeah. So here we are with the GUI, which was designed in a world that was down here, and we're trying to use it to this, so it's not surprising that it just doesn't work, and it's because of the lack of people didn't have them focused on form.
Well, but also with the amorphism, maybe the other objection that people have as you go up, it's the service economy and the kind of jobs you get, probably not high-paying jobs, and probably like, if you are talking about customer-facing jobs, right? Those are they probably don't require as much intellect as you would.
Remember, I'm talking about somebody designing hospital management systems for hospitals. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with me that is an intellectual?
Yeah, I mean, people have been doing that for a while. I mean, you have a system, you have CRM systems for healthcare, you have expert systems, rule-based systems for all of those things. And they do work. Now, I don't know how elegant the healthcare system can be.
I think they work, but they are...
And they are inefficient.
Not inefficient. No. This gets back to the conversation we had before. It's not the performance, it's that they are user hostile. So, no, I'm serious. If And by user, I don't mean programmers, or I don't mean graduates of SDM. I mean nurses and doctors who are just trying to do their job, or insurance people. I don't think they have properly taken them into account. That's my feeling. They are foundational. They were built bottoms up. Well, let me ask you, do you think the iPad was designed bottoms up or tops down? What would you think? I'm sorry?
Tops down.
That's what I think, that elegant design, this is my feeling, is tops down. Now, obviously, you need to have a pretty good idea.
Well, most of these systems are designed for people to use the computer thing. If you get pervasive computing, maybe it will be much easier.
But we have, but we're forcing the nurses and others to learn foundational stuff, and they don't want that. That's all I'm saying. By the way, I'm not saying this negatively. Remember, my point is incredible opportunity. Remember, if the question is why is the internet and all these things disruptive innovations, it's because I believe that in the knowledge economy, they will change all this stuff here in profound ways. But the key profound way is to totally transform the way human beings interface with technology by making making them much more appealing to humans. That's my... And appealing to humans is to say, well, but you mean artists. Well, I don't know. Is industrial design an art, or is it... it feels, at least at the RCA, I don't know if they're artists, but they do there's a lot of sophisticated stuff that goes into it. And if you have more and more tools, massive simulation, design, showing it to people. So the design part needs a massive boost. That's my feeling. And I'm more than my feeling, I also believe that where the money is, because, DRAM is a commodity. It's hard to make a new innovation in DRAM or even in relational databases, whereas up here, somebody reinvents it. That I believe that's where the big... That it's a personal belief. Yes, somebody else had a question, and then...
Actually, I just thought it's a very interesting topic about how human need to interact with the system.
Yes.
Because people always think, people always underestimate how much effort it takes to make that happen.
Exactly.
And
that's why you celebrate good design, because good design, I think, means somebody got it right.
Right, and usually at the end, the user can only really pick up good or bad, because they don't know why this is so simple. Right? Because of all the engineering behind thinking about how to make it as simple as possible. In fact,
yeah. Well, that's why next week we'll spend a lot of the class on Eric von Hippel's theory of end-user innovation, democratizing innovation, because you really want as much as possible the end users involved in this process.
And
so it's precisely because of your point. The more you get the end users involved, the more you have a chance of developing something that will be appealing to the end user.
And I guess maybe just one last point that I thought is really interesting. I just read an article. It's about someone Weiser. He said the most profound technologies are the ones that disappear.
Yes, I agree totally. Right,
so you don't even need a manual to operate.
That's right.
That's when you know it's so robust, so reliable, so easy to use.
Yeah. You see, that design, would you agree? That's a conversation about design. That's exactly a conversation about design. I agree totally. That's exactly a conversation about design.
Basically, anything that requires expertise to run something, that is not elegant enough.
Yeah, you know, and remember, it's a gradation. You say, oh, well, so the most elegant design is any of us can do brain surgery. Well, you know, we're taking it to that degree. And even let's take ERP systems for MIT. It's okay to say you don't mean consumers need to be able to operate it. So that's why it's so interesting, and we'll talk more about this next time. You have to have a pretty good idea who is your end user. Because, let's say, in a hospital management system, the doctors, nurses, administrators, they have to be the end users. Would we agree with that? Maybe even the patients have to be the end users. So you need to at least make sure they are usable by them, I would say. At the very least, by them. But do they have to be usable by somebody in this field? Not necessarily. But when they become patients, those parts aimed at them, if you really want them to participate, then it has to be very natural.
Also, progressively, what technology is doing is it's replacing what experts used to do. Pregnancy tests, 100 years ago, probably it required an expert to do that. Now you can do it in 5 minutes or whatever.
Yeah, I don't think you have to go 100 years to. I think it was much less than that. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree totally. Please.
It's interesting that you're talking about design because on this month's issue of Fast Company, the headline is, the front cover is actually massive design.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about, actually, there's an article with Steve Jobs in there saying that despite the fact that, Apple product, they do crash, and they have defaults, and mm-hmm. you don't hear anything about that because the design component is so elegant as far as aesthetic that people forget that Apple crashes also. You know, so you compare that with a normal PC, and that actually, eliminates the fact of it's the same.
That's right.
Crashing Apple.
Yeah, no, that's right.
That's
right. Well, I think, and then we'll go to this section, that remember, look at this. Remember, this is all, the reason I showed those slides is because what we're talking about is a talk of technology becoming embedded into everything. So look at the typical home. And, the typical home. Yeah, typical home in a poor village in Africa. Typical, let's say, home in the U.S. And look at the number of devices in that home. And would you agree that in many ways we are we may be in the red zone of complexity for a lot of those devices, and that breakthroughs may very well come from things for the home that make it much easier for most people to deal with that stuff. In whatever way, that just because somebody stepped through, put themselves in the shoes of people dealing with this stuff who are not technology experts and are now dealing with it. For example, I view TiVo as a wonderful example of design. Do you all know what TiVo is? And what TiVo did is they really thought through the user interface. And it's just been wonderful what user interface they've had compared to most others. And that's what enabled them to stay in business. God knows if they'll continue. That's a very good example of design. And again, the beauty is that we can have this discussion about almost, retail store systems and telecommunications. The world is full of systems to go engineer to make them much prettier. But now I'm talking about make them both excellent from the bottom up, and then much attack form and function at the same time. There's no end in sight, and the vast majority of them are marketplace facing, they're not lab facing systems. So let me just talk about how we dealt with some of these key execution questions in the world of e-business, and I'll talk about some more internal organizational questions, and then next week we'll talk about the more market-facing questions. So first, the balance between open and proprietary, in-house versus partnerships and acquisitions, how did we focus and organize the offerings, and then very important, how did we track progress? How do you track progress in disruptive innovations? There is no question that, IBM, before we embraced the internet, IBM was the bastion of proprietary technologies. In fact, IBM was the essence of a vertically integrated company, and that was the mainframes were. That's what they were, because they were designed in the 1960s, where, as we discussed before, you had to be vertically integrated to get the damn thing out the door and get it to work at all. But as we talked in the first class, we didn't continue changing and adapting, so we sort of stayed with the vertically integrated model until it was way past its usefulness. Lou Gerstner, I don't know how many of you have read the book, has some superb comments to make about what it means to stay beyond, and he explains the white shirt. Do you all know that IBM used to be known for white shirts? And the reason for that was that when IBM started changing, selling tabulating equipment, now we're talking the 1930s, 1940s, the people who dealt with the customers, with equipment, they would have been mechanics or something like that, and IBM wanted an image that these were two notches above that. And part of getting that image is to have the people who dealt with the customers wear clothes like what the customers wore. And if the customers wore banks, guess what the bankers wore? They wore dark suits and blue shirts, so IBM told its people. So if they wore dark suits and blue shirts, you wore dark suits and blue shirts. This is in the 30s. And then Lou goes on to explain, then everybody forgot why they did it to begin with. And so here you are in the 1980s when everybody's going around in jeans and so on, except for the IBM people showing up in dark suits and blue shirts. So that's a very good example of an action that once upon a time made a lot of sense, totally outlived its usefulness, but through bureaucracy, people forgot and they thought, oh, that's what it means. And but what was really clear is that if you wanted to embrace the internet, you had to embrace open standards. You couldn't have it both ways. You had to embrace open standards to embrace the internet. You can say, well, how about Microsoft? I guess the answer is, well, there are multiple models. But Microsoft has embraced a lot of open standards, just not Linux and a few others. And if you said, well, so how do you make money if you embrace open standards? And the answer is very carefully. So let's take browsers. And when we first started our internet division, we had an IBM browser. And we had an IBM HTTP stack, which is the basic technology on top of which you build web servers. And we made a decision to get rid of them because the browsers, Netscape was giving away the browsers. When Microsoft entered with Internet Explorer, they were giving away the browser. So it was silly, we felt, to compete in something that you give away. The HTTP stack, which we had one, we also got rid of it because we noticed that when our IBM people needed to run a really high-performance web server like the one for the Olympics, they used Apache, the open server browser. We said, why are you doing that? And they said, well, it's much better than what IBM is building. So in the HTTP stack, not only did Apache had over 60% share and IBM's had 2%, but it was better to boot, that the marketplace is sending you signals when that happens. So we got rid of IBM's proprietary and aggressively embraced Apache. However, on top of Apache, we built web server products like WebSphere. And WebSphere is proprietary. It's built on a foundation that is totally open, but on top of it, what you built around it is proprietary. So getting back to this question of balance, if you think carefully your business models, you can carefully decide that you're going to embrace open standards in a whole layer of the stack, in a whole set of components for your offerings, but then you see the money you're saving here and the skills you're saving here, you now put to enhance it with your own proprietary offerings, and then, you know, WebSphere is a huge business for IBM. Let me give you another example of this balance. Because once IBM got the open bug, you know, we kept marching through, and as you know, IBM really embraced Linux. And you can say, well, how much money do you get for Linux? Well, for Linux, we get almost nothing. Maybe nothing. It's open source. It's downloaded. There are companies that you can get Linux from, Red Hat, Novell, but we're not a distributor. However, IBM has a multi-billion dollar business around Linux. How so? Linux drives sales of servers. So servers running Linux, you obviously don't charge for Linux, you charge for the servers. All of IBM's proprietary software runs on the Linux operating system. So you sell the software, and you make money from that. So if you carefully, this gets back to business model innovation. If you're very careful about where the role of the standards and open source even, and the role of proprietary, you view, to the discussion we had earlier, the open source and standards as almost a way to outsource some of your work to this wonderful community, and then you can participate with that community and probably save 90% of what it would have cost you if you had to do it all by yourself. So that's how we did it here. So first point is, it was a balance, and it's something we keep looking over and over and over and over, and so do every other company. Any comments or questions about this point? It's a very, I think, profound point. Yes?
So when you're basing all your applications on open source and so on.
Not all. I didn't say we're basing all of our. No, no, this is very important. I didn't say all.
Okay, so you're basing a significant share of your systems on open source, and that open source keeps changing because it's open. Everybody's adding stuff. Seems that creates a lot of work in order to keep up with.
Well, but the good open source communities like Apache or Linux have governance that keep the interfaces standard. Because of exactly, you couldn't possibly keep coming out with releases of Linux that make all applications on top of Linux incompatible. You just couldn't do that. So there is a very good governance project. And remember, you don't have to join every open source community. You join the ones that you think make sense, and so you usually do due diligence, and you join those communities that have good governance, and part of good governance is exactly what you're saying. Please.
So what happens if somebody, another company comes and releases an open source version of something like WebSphere?
Well, they exist. No, they exist. And what's the open? There was JBoss and there were some others. Well,
yeah. So in such a situation, how does IBM still continue to make money out of WebSphere?
Excellent question. Because for the most part, the open source communities attack a high volume space, and so you then give up that market and you go to the more complex sections where customers are willing to pay for the extra function, for the testing and the support that you don't get here. That's what it is. Now, will that always be the case? Is it possible this will keep growing up? It's quite possible. It probably will happen. And then you have to keep adding, you know, or could it be that after a while, this is no longer a business? Well, sure. Remember, nothing. But you can make a lot of money here, and eventually you have to move up to the next level.
Yeah, as stuff gets more and more commoditized, you have to keep on innovating.
Exactly. Innovation. You know, gets back to innovation. If you decide I'll make a stand and take them on, often that means you don't want to innovate. Now, if you have 90, you know, if you're a monopolist, have 90% share, that's a hell of a stand because if you don't have, usually when you have a huge share, you control the prices and margins and you have them very high. So the new things are really disruptive, like happened to us in mainframes. Once you're playing in the marketplace, so screw it. If you have to eventually get off, you'll find another set of products to go after.
If somebody else comes up with a free version of WebSphere, that basically means you have to redefine your business.
Because exactly.
Earlier it was developing WebSphere-like products. Now it is something else, like giving services.
Exactly. 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 Or keep doing versions of WebSphere that go up to our business, providing more and more business services, business performance management, and so on. How about the questions about in-house versus partnering and acquisitions? This is another gigantic cultural change. You know, one of the most interesting meetings I ever had with Lou Gerstner and companies when we decided in mid 1996 that we would join Sun and embrace Java. Do you all know what Java is? So it's a layer of software that works on all architectures. It was totally developed by Sun. Sun was IBM's key competitor in the server space. They were kicking our ass. They were just killing us in servers. But Java really was getting a lot of traction, especially for in the internet space and especially for products like WebSphere that we wanted to do. So we had to go and say, we need to do Java. We need to embrace Java. It's what we need. It cuts across all the platforms. Remember, IBM had multiple architectures, so a layer like Java was particularly important to work on multiple architectures. And, yeah, we realized we are working with perhaps our toughest competitor in a very important segment, but they have a good thing. So we joined them, and we worked very closely with them. That was a critical decision because it was embracing Java and something we did called J2EE, Java Enterprise Edition. Is that what it
is? Yeah.
That it allowed us to move forward and build things like WebSphere. Similarly, with SOA, IBM partnered with Microsoft. And IBM and Microsoft have been the primary companies that have pushed service-oriented architectures. And, you know, XML and all this stuff around it. And, you know, do we always agree? I mean, hell no. There are huge battles because, you know, everybody's trying to find its own advantage. However, see, this gets back. Remember these pictures, which is if you're going after this goal, and if you spend time in a skirmish here that your clients could care less, do you think a client cares whether IBM and Microsoft get along? You know, shut up and get your goddamn stuff to work together and let me run my business. I'm being very serious. That then drives your actions as opposed to going to visit a client and say, you know, let me tell you why these some people are bad or the, you know. You can do that if you are competing for a server sale because let me say, my servers are better than their servers. That's a different thing. And clients understand that. But if you're talking about things clients want, integration, and the fact that you guys don't get along is in the way, the clients will punish you by not buying from you if you don't cooperate. So we cooperated. At the same time, there were major areas we were lousy with our internal products, and we had to make acquisitions. And probably the two critical acquisitions we made were Lotus for office systems and collaboration and Tivoli for systems management. Those were critical acquisitions. And prior to those acquisitions, the mood in IBM was that making an acquisition was a failure. That was like, you're not man enough to build it yourself. That was, and I'm not kidding. I mean it, like, if you are good, you would have built it yourself. So the fact that you keep failing for 10 years in a row on office systems, aren't you man enough to try the 11th time? Now, usually, if you fail for 10 years, maybe there is something in your DNA, in the culture of the company, that makes it very difficult to do certain kinds of systems. So as we talked about, I believe, last week, you are not good at everything. And if you say, well, but I should be good at that, well, maybe you should be good at that. You are not. So if you are not, then you need an injection of culture and talent, obviously. You don't just buy culture. A McKinsey study that tells you how to change your culture. You can do that too. Give them a lot of money and that and $5 will get you a nice cup of coffee. But you really, no, when it comes to culture, there are many other things that will help you a lot. But what you really need often, as we discussed last time, is an injection of new blood. And these acquisitions were new blood. And IBM culture has changed radically. So we've become more open to acquisitions like Cisco has and other companies. So often there are companies in the marketplace that are very successful. They have done something. Could we have done it? Absolutely, we could have done it, but we didn't do it. It's like asking you, well, why didn't you buy this stock when it was low and now it's so high? Couldn't you have bought it? Yes, you could have bought it. Why didn't you buy? Well, you know, sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. And, you know, but it takes, it sounds like I'm being glib, but it takes, culturally, you have to think objectively as opposed to feeling like you failed, and therefore, because you didn't do it, you're not going to make the acquisition, and the net result is you won't be successful in the marketplace. That's really stupid. But we had to get that cultural barrier. This pushed us to get questions. Now, when we were starting with the business and organizing our offerings, we had to pick certain things we would do, certain things we won't do. I already told you, we said browsers, the probability. First of all, Microsoft and Netscape were having what people call the browser wars. Do you all know what I'm talking about? So, could we have thrown our hat in the ring in those browser wars? We could have, but we all knew how that would have ended, that we would have been crushed between these two people fighting for their lives. Microsoft felt that if Netscape established dominance in their browser, it put their whole Windows franchise in peril. So they were going to do whatever it took. And Netscape was fighting for its life, which eventually it lost. And we wouldn't have done anything there. So we got out of that. But we found that people who were trying to do e-business, remember, integrate the web with IT, our enterprise customers, needed a number of important things we were very good at. Security. Remember, now, for the first time, you were opening your jewels, applications, and data to everybody. And I don't need to tell you, not everybody out there who came in was a good guy. So all of a sudden, firewalls and security, that became a very big business. Build security. Hosting. For the first time, remember, before the internet, everybody knew exactly how big a machine they needed, how big everything they needed, because they knew exactly how many people were going to access it. With the internet, you had no idea. So a lot of people said, God, this is a pain in the ass. Why don't you host it for me and you handle the variable scalability of hosting? So we developed hosting services. Backend integration. Integrate the legacy backends. A lot of it was IBM systems with the new web servers from IBM and others. So we built a whole set of new offerings, some are services, some are products that were very, very valuable in the internet and fit what we were good at. And then we started to organize the internet offerings, and these three categories, which we actually came up with in 96, in fact, they continue to make a lot of sense. And we said, when all is said and done, there are three classes of applications in the world of the web. Content, collaboration, and commerce. And so we started counting everything. also our market, their communications, our education, content collaboration, and commerce, over and over and over and over. The reason this is very important is we don't say, well, God, what the hell is an e-business application that is too amorphous a subject? But if we say, okay, let's talk about content. What do you mean by content? Well, how about a website? Do you have a website? I don't have a goddamn website. Well, we can help you build a website. How do you help me build a website? So now you can start doing offerings. Customer self-service. By the way, I think customer self-service, in retrospect, was the killer app in the world of the web. Things like FedEx, UPS, and huge number of others that allow people to do for themselves things they couldn't do before, get access to information, those exploded. Those were, I think, the killer apps. And those primarily required back-end web integration and security. Remember, you open up the data center to everybody, you had to have very good security. So we developed that. Collaboration played very well because of our Lotus acquisition. We positioned Lotus Notes very much as a platform for collaboration and started building more and more offerings. Also, a lot of the intranet applications inside the company to help employees share information and communicate were collaboration in nature. And then commerce. And remember, especially, not at the beginning, 96, 97, but around, you know, as the internet got better, e-commerce just took off. And there was B2C and B2B, and you'll hear in 2 weeks from Chris McCormick of L.L. Bean, who was actually our launch partner for our e-commerce platform. And this kept going up more and more and more and more. So we started imposing a structure that proved very beneficial, if nothing else, because it allowed the salespeople to know what the hell to talk about. Otherwise, they say, internet. Well, good. What do you want me to do? Well, you have to have the internet. Well, you have to do more than that.
Mentioned content. Did IBM ever think of doing a search engine portal?
Yes. And we did some, like, for patents. We did a superb, but just didn't, it never developed into a business. We tried, the first year I was the general manager of the internet division, I spent more time killing offerings we had started in the past than building new ones, because we had started a lot of user-oriented activities that we were lousy at, and substituting it for things we were much better at. And because we just were not good at it. I don't know, you know, it's almost like if you say, why is, again, Michael Jordan not good at basketball? I'm sorry, not good at baseball. Not as good in baseball as in basketball. I don't know, but we were just not as good in those things. So we tried a lot, and we tried and killed. We killed lots of stuff. We killed lots and lots of stuff. Now, the last one is very interesting, because we needed to count something, because if you didn't count anything, how the hell did you know if you were making progress? Counting revenue and profit didn't make any sense, because this stuff was just ramping up. So in the first few years, what we counted primarily was marquee accounts in each area that we were interested. So when we had reviews with Gerstner and others, okay, so what new clients do we have in content, in collaboration, in commerce, in finance industry, distribution industry, transportation industry? And so we were counting the really, how were we winning in each major area that we were after, but we were defining winning as these clients were partnering with us. The deals were initially not very large. So from the point of view of the bottom line, they were minuscule. But if you didn't do those deals, you didn't exist. I mean, when I say they were minuscule, if you were a brand new company, you were very proud of those deals. Remember the discussions we had that if you're a larger company, the bar for what catches management attention is so high that you leave a lot of good ideas on the table. However, if you count engagements by industry, by clients, and all of a sudden you can start asking questions, well, Jesus, why did Citibank go with our competitor in this area instead of with us? I mean, that, what's wrong? Is that are we upset or not? Yes, we're very upset. Well, why did we lose? So you can start asking questions like that. We had a few set of projects. We counted also financials, but how can I say that? You know, it wasn't counting like a mature sector doing true quarterly earnings. What we were doing in the early stages was below the radar when it comes to quarterly earnings, rounding off, which is true anytime you're starting something new. However, there were a few key products we were counting. How are we doing in Lotus products, Domino in particular? So we counted those. How are we doing in WebSphere when it started? So we were counting those. How about hosting deals? We were counting those. And then we counted subjectively how much revenue from the other parts of the company are being driven as a result of the Internet initiative. So if a client bought extra mainframes because of this new e-business application, obviously the revenue for the mainframe went to the systems unit, but we counted that as indirect revenue. And after a while, we had like over 20-25% of IBM's revenues were due to the Internet, and by then the game was over. You know, when you get to that number, it's time to go away because now you're paying to, you know, let them do the work themselves. So we had to count, because if you don't have the discipline of measuring, you don't have any discipline and you don't know if you're winning or losing, but you cannot count what you count in a mature business that is material to the quarterly earnings. Any questions or comments? And, you know, we'll review this some more when we start next week. Thank you very much, and I'll see you on Thursday.